The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Tech Weekly podcast. My name is Keith Stewart. I'm the Games Commissioning Editor for The Guardian. And today we are handling the big face-off between the next-gen consoles, PlayStation 4 versus Xbox One. And to join me today to talk about this in the delightful Guardian Cafe in Shoreditch, and you can probably hear the bustle of baristas and people drinking coffee and looking at iPad screens behind me. But we're here right in front of me. I'm joined by three people who hopefully should have interesting points of view on this debate. First of all, for the deputy editor of T3 is Matt Hill. Hello, Matt.
Hello, thanks for having us.
That's quite all right. I hope you're enjoying your coffee.
It's very nice, very warm.
Good. And we have a developer of the BAFTA award-winning Thomas Was Alone, Mike Bithell. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for that. It is lovely coffee.
It's good. Like, and finally, we have the news editor of Eurogamer, Wesley Yin Paul.
Hello. And I've already had my latte, and very nice it was indeed, in a glass cup.
Yeah. I know. That's. It looks lovely, doesn't it? But it burns your fingers.
Well, it's just warm, really. Mm.
Much like a console.
Yeah, talking about burning. Well, I think what we should do is we should start really from the beginning of the story. Let's talk about the hardware a little bit and what these machines tell us about console gaming. And the interesting thing about these consoles is that they're, to a lot of people, are going to appear virtually identical. They're both 8-core central processing units, an AMD GPU, Blu-ray player. But there are sort of infinitesimal differences, I think, in terms of, I think the PS4 GPU is slightly more powerful, or it has more compute units, and it has a different type of memory. But that's great. I mean, these are the thrilling things that everyone wants from a console, aren't they? Yeah. So, I mean, is that a good, if I characterise that correctly, guys? Yes. Matt?
Yeah. The RAM is on paper faster on the PS4, which is the GDDR5 next to GDDR3. Hmm. But yeah, I mean, the specifications are, let's not beat about the bush, very, very similar. I mean, I think they are kind of like, a lot of people are saying, like, now high-end gaming PCs, and it's got to that point now where they are kind of like that. And it does seem that kind of the hardware, in a way, has kind of been slightly, from our point of view, anyway, slightly forgotten, because for T3, that's what we focus on a lot with, you know, how powerful things are, you know, where tech's going. But this whole argument between PS4 and Xbox so far has seeming kind of like not been about that, which is the kind of most interesting thing I find about it. It's probably the least spec-heavy battle that I've seen in recent years.
Yeah, yeah. And Wes, how have your readers reacted? Because you have a writer called Richard Ledbetter who writes for you, and he runs Digital Foundry, and he goes into massive depth on the tech specifications. And how have your readers kind of reacted to his stories and the way that he's had to sort of really infinitesimally get into the hardware?
Yeah, it's actually fascinating because there's, on the one hand, you've got what looks like on paper, as we've said, is a more powerful PlayStation compared with Xbox. But when you break it down, what will probably happen, at least in the short to medium term, is most games will end up looking very, very similar and will run very, very similarly. As we've seen with past console generations throughout history, you don't really see a console's full potential until towards the end of the life cycle. Mm-hmm. You know, we're seeing that with PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 now, with games like The Last of Us and Halo 4. Imagine if you'd have shown those games when those consoles were announced, you know, that compare them to the games, the launch lineup then. So what we're seeing now is quite an interesting debate about specs regarding the next generation consoles. But really, none of this will realise its potential for maybe 8 years, 7 years. So it's quite an interesting debate to have now. But I think like you said, it's kind of like other areas of it are more interesting, at least in the short to medium term.
Yeah, yeah. Mike, I mean, from the development community, what's the reaction been to the hardware itself? We'll get onto the other stuff in a minute.
But. Well, I think it's as these guys said, they are much of a muchness. It's the kind of, it is the post cross platform console generation, right? It's like it happened with the previous generations, but in this one they aren't trying to differentiate. They're basically both trying to make systems that will run most of the games. Mm. There's also much less reliance on exclusives, it seems, this time around. I think it's a good platform. They're both brilliant from kind of a PC-centric kind of development platform, so there's not the problems. You know, Sony platforms traditionally have always been, well, they've gotten better basically with each generation to develop for. PlayStation 2 was a nightmare, PS3 was much better, PS4 looks like it's going to be kind of just a PC, and just a PC is probably the best possible development platform because it's what most developers have the most experience with, because PCs have been around a while and they've just been getting incrementally better rather than these kind of weird systems you get in consoles. So it's good for developers, definitely, hardware wise, both places.
Yeah. So if we look at the what happened earlier this year with the console launches, and PlayStation went first in February, and there were a lot of criticisms after the PlayStation launch that it was kind of slightly lackluster, and they showed lots of games and they had a big section on indie games, but people felt it wasn't really. I mean, people were annoyed because they didn't see the console. Which was kind of the big thing at the time, and that's what caused the big controversy. Little did everyone know what was going to come. But I mean, after the PlayStation conference, Matt, what did you think of Sony's job, how they set up the next gen?
Well, we were obviously all out there and chatting about it, and I was very interested in the kind of feedback, because me personally, I thought it was kind of fine. I thought, you know, it was kind of a nice entry into, you know, explaining kind of what it would do, showing the controller, showing what they were working on. For me, I didn't see not having the box as a big deal, and I think that kind of played out by the way that Microsoft did show the box and then still got loads of flak, so it didn't really matter. But I think it showed that people have very short memories, and I think, you know, everyone, once they got to Microsoft's conference, had completely forgotten that the PlayStation one hadn't gone down very well. And it was similarly at E3. Once we got to the PlayStation conference, everyone had kind of forgotten that Microsoft's conference was actually okay. It was pretty good, it had some strong stuff, had some interesting stuff. Obviously everything went mental over the kind of the ethics and the price and everything. But I actually thought of PlayStation 4, I came away with it kind of, you know, quite G'd by it. A good mix of developers, a good mix, game mix of, you know, big titles and smaller titles, and I thought they were all making the right noises even then, but it did seem that the internet sometimes needs an excuse to be angry about something.
Yeah, it doesn't sometimes need that excuse, it needs it constantly 24 hours a day. Mike, and immediately Sony came in with this determination to embrace indie, didn't it? And it felt to me like for once, it wasn't about, oh yeah, we sort of like indies, let's pat them on the head because they're cute and they're friendly. It felt as though, no, this is serious now, because independent games, you know, since obviously the dawn of Minecraft and how massively important that is, everyone suddenly realised that independent games is going to be really important, and they pushed that right from the beginning, didn't they?
I think so, and I think even before, I mean, I, if you look back at Sony's history, they have a pretty good track record of bringing these kind of esoteric, weird little games, and also obviously, you know, bringing in developers for multiple games, like the game company guys. So it's definitely been a history there. I think the big change is they've realised that the processes in their business kind of are catered for a larger publisher or a larger developer. And what they've done is they've stripped away a lot of that complexity, or hidden it behind the scenes, to allow more indies to get onto their platform easier. So I've just been through the process with my last game, and yeah, the amount of kind of processes and bureaucracy that I've seen in previous projects where I've worked in bigger companies, those have all been removed or hidden or made easier. So I think that's the biggest thing, and it's not as sexy a story, but that's the reason I think indies are quite so excited, is because, oh my goodness, I can just get my game on a console now. That's massive.
What we've not taken into consideration so far is this whole idea of the second screen, which seems to be a really important part of, well, will be an important part of this generation. Obviously, PlayStation 4 is going to align very heavily with Vita, so you'll maybe be able to use your PlayStation Vita as an extra controller for your PlayStation, but you also may be able to remotely play PlayStation 4 games. So if someone's using your big television, you can take your PlayStation 4 game and play it on your Vita elsewhere, because it connects to the PlayStation via a local network, which is quite interesting. Microsoft are doing a similar sort of one with an idea with their Smart Glass application, which again will allow people to play Xbox One games on their tablet. So they're both playing, and also, you know, Nintendo have done this as well with Wii U, with their gamepad, which has another screen. And is this, do we think this is actually going to be important? Are people going to really use this service, Matt?
Well, I was going to add that, because it just seems, you touched on Nintendo, so I wanted to kind of get in there quickly, because it was worth noting that the Wii U games at E3, very few of them used the touchscreen to any great degree. And it was quite interesting of sort of a system that has kind of focused on that as a main selling point, that they kind of almost seem to be moving away from it. Like Mario Kart 8, you literally just like honk the horn on the screen. That's literally it. So I find the thing is, Vita has actual controls. You know, this is the classic thing. You know, most smart glass stuff I've seen, and I'm sure they will obviously move in a different direction than that, but most smart glass stuff I've seen is kind of like supplementary controls, and I do wonder how much as a second screen experience that has to offer, you know, do I really want to stop playing Dead Rising 3 and to do an air strike, I have to pick up my phone and like it doesn't seem, well, I can't just put that on the controller. Stuff like that doesn't seem to me to be adding anything. Mm-hmm. But then you look at what Ubisoft are doing with some of their apps, and that's genuinely interesting, having like mini games away from things that feed into it. But very interestingly, they're using their own apps. They're not doing that through smart glasses app or any, you know, so that's quite interesting. But I think Vita, we'll finally get all of the things that we said we were going to get for the PS3, which was like remote play, which didn't happen apart from a handful of games, and you know, streaming games, and the kind of the whole kind of crossplay has given Vita a massive boost. The fact that you pay for it once and you get it on both, and I think this could really give the Vita a second wind. I've always been a big fan, but I think, you know, with an inevitable price cut in the build up, I think that's going to be quite a strong addition.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Wes, let's move on to the Xbox launch, the Xbox event in Redmond. I know your editor Tom Bramwell was there because I was sitting next to him through the conference. And I mean, the Xbox One, the conference in Redmond, in this tent on the Microsoft campus, was very much, it seemed to me, very much aimed at 20 to 30 year old American men who love sports. Yeah, who love sports, who are really, who are really interested in the idea of being able to watch ESPN and NFL games while playing on their Xbox, because it was all about TV deals, it was all about sports, it was all about being able to swap between your cable service provider, which you could access through Xbox, and onto your sort of cable TVs, you could play NFL and watch NFL. And that seemed to be the whole idea. It was about TV and interconnectivity between TV and games. And that, I mean, what was, again, how did Eurogamer react to that message?
Negatively. I mean, Eurogamer readers typically are core gamers who enjoy playing video games, shock, horror. And Microsoft's announcement event seemed to focus more on things that weren't gaming. So it's a natural, understandable reaction from most gamers, I think, not just a Eurogamer, but across the internet, I'll try and be nice. They were skeptical, to say the least, about what Microsoft were doing.
And obviously, and what they also failed to do is, straight afterwards, all the press were herded into executive interviews with key personnel. And I know your editor, Tom Brown, I went to speak to Phil Harrison, and I spoke to Chris Lewis, the head of Microsoft Europe. And we said, okay, that was all exciting, but what about gamers? I noticed, this console seems to be very heavily reliant on digital distribution. What does this mean for games? What does this mean for how we pass on our games? Pre-owned games, selling on games is really important to a lot of gamers because, you know, they're expensive. What can we do with our digitally distributed games? Are they ours to keep? Will we be able to pass those on to friends? How will we share games? And there were no answers. They weren't telling us anything. Not only were they not telling us anything, they weren't just not telling us anything, they were telling us different versions of nothing. Chris Lewis told me something very different from what Tom Brammer was told by Phil Harrison. Phil Harrison actually called Tom back in to try and explain again, didn't he?
I was just going to say, I've never known anything like this. I was back in the UK assisting with our reporting of this event, while Tom Bramwell also was in the US at the event at Redmond. And he interviewed Phil Harrison, who runs Xbox in Europe, essentially, and was told some very confusing things about how Xbox One would work and how games would work. And we reported on what he said, thinking that it would be accurate because it came from Phil Harrison. And then it didn't turn out to be quite so accurate. He mentioned a fee associated with selling games secondhand. And I remember at the time, Microsoft's Xbox support Twitter account said there would be no fee. So we were getting mixed messages. And this is when the unprecedented thing happened. Microsoft approached Tom Bramwell and said, can we do that again? Phil would like to clarify a few points. And so he interviewed him again. And then it was a similar mixed, like confusing message about how everything would work. And it was just incredible scenes, basically. You know, people didn't really know what was going on. People were angry and they weren't sure why and how or what they should be angry about and whether it was all true. And it was just an incredible, crazy terrible time for Microsoft.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah. Matt, I mean, you know, I've written something for T3 about this, and we've
very
talked
good it was
about
too.
It. Yeah, and you know, we talked about the fact we completely understand why Microsoft didn't go onto its stage with its new console and say, "Here's Xbox One, it's the future," and by the way, here's what you do with pre-owned games.
Yeah.
But you feel as though they should have had that message ready for when the press inevitably asked about it afterwards. I mean, but for your readers, what did your read? Because you have a much more mainstream readership. How did they react?
Well, our readers are interested in it as much as a set-top box as they are in games. So games is just one facet of what it does. But obviously, they want really, really good games as well. It's not like, you know, it's not transferable. But I mean, it's worth noting, we went out 3 weeks before the launch to Redmond and I spoke to them then, and they said completely different things then that weren't reported at the launch. So it does seem that kind of the message was changing almost on an hourly basis, and they hadn't quite confirmed it yet, but we're talking about it, which is quite bizarre, because it could have, other things they weren't talking about, so it could have been quite easy to have not talked about it. But no, when we went out there, I mean, we're really interested in the tech behind it, and you know, it's not a popular thing to talk about, but Kinect is really, really impressive. The new Kinect is incredible. And that, I think, Microsoft has lost a lot of the good messaging it should have done by doing bad messaging. And I think the fact is, like, once you've had a go on Kinect, it is everything they promised with the first one and more, which is scary in one way and scary in another way. And it's actually only been spiraled out into the scary and, oh, privacy, oh, you know, it's going to always be on. And not, you know, the fact that, you know, the infrared stuff on it, so that, you know, that, so it takes out all of the light interference, so that, you know, it can see you in the dark. The fact that, you know, it can monitor six people at once. It's no, from a tech perspective, it's genuinely unbelievable. The fact that it can read your heart rate, you know, like the games you could base around that, like, and, you know, I just found it fascinating from a technological perspective, and then just to see that, how, like, from that initial view of seeing, like, wow, this is some really, really cool stuff in it, and then basically just seeing it unravel and seeing them lose any of that in the way they got it across.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was two problems with Kinect. One is that no one liked the first Kinect. Lots of people bought it, and Microsoft obviously saw that happening, but people couldn't use it because everyone's houses are too small, the games weren't that good, the sensors wasn't...
Everyone's houses were not too small. Kinect was too big. Everyone always says, oh, my room was too small for Kinect. No, no, no. They built a Kinect that required too big a room.
Yeah.
My room is okay. You know, I can sort of swing a cat. If Kinect can't work in my room, it's something wrong with Kinect, not my room.
Yeah, I think that's definitely it. And but I think as well, what didn't help Kinect was that it was announced, and all its features, which do sound quite scary, were announced at the same time as the, you know, as the NSA data came out, and everyone suddenly, the news of the day was paranoia, surveillance. And lots of people are saying, I don't want this thing in the corner of my room watching me while I'm sitting eating my dinner. And yeah, this built a whole life of its own that surely Microsoft possibly couldn't have foretold, Mike.
And then The Guardian made it even worse with the whole Prism story and all that.
Exactly.
That's the thing, is, and I think these guys are right to highlight it. It feels like more of a marketing failure than a hardware failure. Like all of this stuff, the Kinect is awesome, but my girlfriend doesn't want it in our living room because it's always on, because of, you know, the nastiness of all that stuff. The idea of owning a game essentially in a digital format immediately when you get the disc is really cool. Like there's awesome stuff about that. The idea that I can lend it to friends, that kind of stuff, digitally, is a really cool feature. All of this stuff is really good, but it's been told to us in such a way that we all immediately paranoidly kind of went to these expectations.
Another interesting thing was that after the launch, Microsoft started coming out with these things where they were saying, well, hang on, we're trying to move the industry ahead here with digital distribution. We're offering you the possibility, we're offering you a system which we haven't really explained, but that might allow you to pass on your digital downloads to other people. And also, you might be able to share your games with up to 10 other friends. And suddenly, all of this started coming out. And they tried to present their digital distribution model as something forward-thinking and futuristic. And lots of their gamers started saying, well, actually, that's true, because when I trade in a game at GameStop or Game, I get a really bad return on that. So, wow, that actually did sound quite interesting. But obviously the internet being what it is, you know, an enormous feral beast that doesn't shut up. 2 weeks ago...
Wow.
Sorry, I'm gonna get killed for that one. 2 weeks ago, John Matrick wrote on the Xbox Wire website that they've had a little think, they've listened to the commentary from the web, and they've decided to change track and they're going back. And you know, each game you'll be able to trade them freely. You won't have to go online every 24 hours, which is what they were going to say, that to authenticate your games, you're going to have to go, your Xbox can have to be online every 24 hours. So they massively backpedaled. What was the reaction, Wes, at Eurogamer to this news?
Well, you know the end of the Star Wars saga when everyone is like, all the Ewoks are celebrating and fireworks. It wasn't like that.
Right. That's a shame.
It was weird. I've never known anything like it. I don't think anyone who has ever seen anything like it before. Not just a backtracking feature set, but a complete backtracking philosophy, which I think is the more interesting aspect of all of this. These things are many years in the making, and a lot of people have paid a lot of money to come up with what they think is going to be a console that will last 10 years. And to, before it's even launched, just kind of change the whole thing so it's kind of like the last one, just more powerful, is just, I couldn't believe it. And people, I think, were shocked, rightly so, kind of wanted to be happy about it, but then, you know, found other things to be upset about as well. It was just a strange, shocking situation. And I think that looking further forward, you know, these consoles are ever evolving and will continue to evolve. Who knows what, you know, the Xbox One is, how it's going to work in a couple of years. But right now, I think it's one of the biggest stories in gaming has ever had.
So we've covered all the background. We should go on to the launch proposition now of the consoles. PS4 is going to launch at £350.
Yeah, £349. Yeah.
£349, and Xbox is going to be at £429. And release dates, what does everyone think? I mean, Xbox has obviously said November, PlayStation has said before the end of 2013. I think November is probably quite likely.
Yeah. I imagine so.
In terms of games, I mean, there's some interesting third-party games. Wes, I mean, what are the third-party games you think are going to be the sort of key sellers at the start of this generation?
Call of Duty and FIFA.
Wow.
I'm not dissing those games or the people who play them. I'm going to buy a next gen console this year for the next FIFA. Mm. I'm a huge FIFA fan, and I played the next gen FIFA at E3. It's incredible. And I don't want to sit there on my Xbox 360 and play a current gen FIFA thinking and knowing that there's a better version that I'm not playing. I feel like a second class citizen. So it looks like I'm going to have to spend a few hundred quid, or maybe a few more hundred quid, just to play FIFA. And I know it's ridiculous and irrational, but FIFA is bigger than Call of Duty pretty much at this stage in the UK. And there's going to be hundreds of thousands of people who'll be faced with, you know, I don't really care about any other games, you know, I kind of want to play the best version of FIFA or Call of Duty. And that's why I'm going to get an extra. I think those two games are the reasons to upgrade for most people more than any of the first party stuff I've seen.
Mike, from what do you think of the launch lineup of games? There's some platform exclusives as well, though not that many. PlayStation 4 has got Killzone, Shadowfall, Knack from Mark Cerny, which looks quite interesting. Mark Cerny was one of the original developers on Sonic the Hedgehog 2 and Spyro and Crash, and Drive Club as well, which is open world driving game from Evolution Studios. Xbox has got Kinect Sports Rivals, so we'll all get to use Kinect.
Yeah.
And Rise, Son of Rome, the Crytek Roman hack-em-up. And I think Dead Rising 3, is that going to be a launch title?
I mean, to be honest, I'm less excited about the Microsoft exclusives. Like, Dead Rising, that was always the colourful zombie game, and now it's the brown zombie game. And there's already a few of them. So I think
we
that's less
interesting.
Yeah, I'm sorry. There's been a couple of those in the last few years. So I mean I like Killzone. Knack looks interesting. I imagine it'll be a little bit rushed, because often the family game on the new console is rushed. I hope that's not the case, but it's exciting. To be honest, I'm an idiot gamer, so I'm going to buy it for all of the games that are also coming out on current gen platforms, but will look a bit shinier. So I'll get it for Watch Dogs. I'll get it for those games, which is foolish, and I'm in a very small minority. I agree with what you said. I think it's going to be a FIFA machine, at least for the first few months for most people. But yeah, I'll grab them and play stuff I should be playing on other platforms.
And Matt, what about you? What interests you when those machines come out in, looks like, November?
Yeah, I mean, similarly, I mean, I wasn't completely blown away by the exclusive titles, and also the more I dig into it, the more things that seem exclusive are only either timed exclusives or are coming out on other formats as well. Titanfall looks very interesting on the one. Obviously, that's not coming out at launch, but also that's coming out on the 360 and the PC, I think. So it's the exclusive aren't as exclusive as they seem. The best person at E3, I thought, was for that kind of stuff was Ubisoft. I thought they had a fantastic show. They had such a variety of things they were doing, and things like The Division and Watch Dogs just looked genuinely really interesting, and their worlds looked like a real step on. You know, I think like Rise, Son of Rome that you mentioned was kind of like, that was a previous Kinect title which they've kind of put buttons on now, and
it's buttons.
It's almost like QuickTime events almost, kind of with a kind of mixed combat. But it looks great, you know, storming beaches, it's all very Roman Call of Duty, but the action didn't really do it for me. Yeah. And I found that Ubisoft, especially the second screen stuff, which I think people think is very faddy, but I think they're doing really interesting stuff, and they've got apps for everything they're doing. Like, just little things like the Assassin's Creed 4 app, which is basically like a little mini Sid Meier's Pirates, and you send off like your thing. So rather than having to do all the boring collecting stuff while you're there, when you just want to get through the story, you can do all that on your tablet, and it feeds into your game. And like, that's where I think second screen stuff needs to go, yeah. You can be using it away from your console. Like, you could do a load of stats, and you could like do transfers for FIFA. I don't know that they're doing this, but they should.
Yeah, they're not sure they are.
Is that you could do all that kind of stuff, and then you get back and you just play the game. You don't have to spend ages doing that, because touchscreens were made that much better. Anyway, that's the development that needs to happen. Rather than it being stuff while you're playing, it needs to be stuff that can continue your game.
I think, and I think really to finish off with the last sentence from all of you, I'm interested, you know, Wes, I think this was you that said this, that, you know, the really interesting games are the ones like a few years down the line. You know, what we're seeing now on Xbox 360 and PS3, like Last of Us and Halo, it looks spectacular, and they're really interesting games. Yeah. So what can we expect from games on this generation? What is going to define this generation? Because for me, it looks like it might be ideas like cloud gaming and this whole idea that in the future, games on PS4 and Xbox One are going to be pervasive, massively multiplayer, persistent worlds. These ideas are kind of interesting. I wonder if that's going to be what's going to really scream next generation to us. And I don't know. We'll start with you.
Yeah, well, I've written about this actually. I think next generation will be defined by open world. There's going to be, but in a different way to what we believe is open world now. It's going to be connected. It's going to be constantly evolving, and it will be designed for you to play over a long period of time, as opposed to, you know, many games you kind of play them and then you finish them and that's it, and then you move on to the next thing. These games are going to be designed to try and keep you engaged for many years. It's kind of like MMOs, but they're not calling them MMOs. On console, they're like living worlds or something, you know. But it's essentially the likes of The Division, which is a very, very interesting game. Watch Dogs is getting there. Destiny from Bungie is pretty much an MMO without the term MMO.
Which is massively multiplayer online.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the games, next generation games, will be defined by their open world nature. Maybe sandbox style elements, you know, sort of Just Cause style stuff. How they're connected, so they'll have multiplayer elements, but you can sort of dip in and out of that, whether you want to play solo or whatever, you know, or you can play multiplayer, that kind of thing. And they're constantly evolving, so things will change, they'll update, and all of this sort of stuff will fuse so that we'll get these incredible, beautiful, like better graphics than we've ever seen, constantly updating, evolving worlds that we can enter in and play half an hour on our own, get something out of it, or play it like with like 5 or 10 people and get loads of out of it. all of that kind of thing. I think that is the kind of genre that will emerge as the most popular next gen.
Okay, Mike. Oh, sorry. Mike, from a developer's point, I mean, maybe even from an indie developer's perspective.
Well, I was going to say,
Thomas was alone going to go into a pervasive
Well, it is now. No, I think, yeah, from a completely selfish point of view, the thing that excites me about these platforms is the rise of the of a new mid-level developer, the rise of a studio that's maybe 20 people tops making a niche game. If these consoles can sort out the discoverability issue in the way that PC games have, it's going to be a very cool way of players finding exactly that weird little niche title they want. On PC, if you're a fan of any genre, there's probably 3 or 4 indie games being made which specifically focus you. That's not happened on console yet. That's what I'm hoping for, is this kind of this rise of these smaller games. The big titles will exist and they'll bring in the big audiences, we'll never match them, but it's becoming massively economically sustainable to target, you know, 30,000, 40,000 people, which is not many people with a console, and make something that's specifically for them. That's the stuff that excites me.
Okay, Matt?
To not echo the persistent world, which obviously is very true, but to kind of point, for me it's like connectivity, and it's going to be really interesting to see how that is played out across both. You know, they both have supplementary apps, but it's going to be very interesting to see to what extent the interactivity is, to what extent you can, you know, PlayStation has got the advantage with the Vita. So as you're saying about kind of the rise of kind of smaller independent games, you'll be able to port them straight over. What are Microsoft going to do in comparison to that? Are you going to be able to port them over to your phone through an app? Is that going to happen? Are they even going to go down that route? Or is it literally going to be an interactivity thing? For me, it's people taking stuff on the move, and to be playing your game at all times is a really interesting concept. And I think for me, that would be next gen. I play a lot of Vita FIFA, and I play FIFA on my PlayStation. They do not connect up. There is no reason why they shouldn't connect up, and I should be playing the same season. For me, that would be next gen. The fact that I don't ever have to leave the world that I'm playing, regardless of where I am. And both have made kind of noises in that, you know, and as well as like PlayStation with Gaikai and stuff like that, that might be coming, and it is coming, but when it comes, we don't know. I find that very interesting, the fact that I can, that will enable them to tap in more into the Apple world, which they are really fighting, whether they, you know, accept it or not. That kind of always online isn't just for being at home, always online is wherever you are, and I find that would be really kind of define the next gen.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's it. So that's Xbox One versus PS4, I think, pretty much sorted out. Well, yeah. I'd just like to say thank you so much to my guests today, Matt Hill, Mike Bithell, and Wesley and Paul. Thank you so much, guys. I'm Keith Stewart. Today, Tech Weekly was produced by Jason Phipps, and I'd like to say a special thank you to the staff at Guardian Coffee for providing us with lattes and hospitality. We'll speak to you next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.